Good morning, Professor Sill. Good morning, Professor Sill. This is Pankaj Jain. Thank you for your time. I'm going to interview you now for this series of webinars that we are launching as part of American Academy of Indic Studies. We launched our journal last spring 2018, in which you very kindly agreed to publish a book review, a review of a book by Professor Wendy Doniger at the University of Chicago. And so I'm going to ask you some. I'm going to request you to share the what you reviewed in that review, so for our viewers, so they can get to read your review. And also, I guess we should start with your own introduction, how you started in Kolkata, and then you came to North America and so on. So all yours, please.
Thank you, Professor Jain. Thank you for inviting me to hold this conference with you. My journey into basically what turns out to be the religious history of Bengal and then India at large began in a very peculiar way. I began my studies with the history of Tudor England in the 16th century England, and then I found that there is a lot of similarities between Tudor England and India during the time of Akbar. That was in my mind. And anyway, my first foray in the world of publication is a book and articles on Tudor England. But then I actually was interested, because I like Tudor England, I was interested in finding out how much the Englishmen and women of the 16th century came in contact with India, basically Calcutta, as a trader, and then in a remarkable historical way, they were responsible for introducing a lot of ideas which meshed with in India's inherited culture, and it was not that foreign or unknown, and that spawned what is called the movement of the Bengal Renaissance. And why I was doing that, I was particularly interested in an area of Renaissance time, that's the area of Hindu revivalism. Incidentally, let me mention here, Professor Doniger, in her book, Redeeming Kama Sutra, which I reviewed, she actually makes Bengal Renaissance Hindu Renaissance. And then she makes it that it is the, its contribution is on Hinduism. No, Hindu movement was, again, it was in connection with, what should I say, contact and impact of contact with an impact of the metropolitan culture, that we had the Brahmo religion or Brahmo movement. We call it a movement. And then from Brahmo movement began the inward looking enterprise on the part of English educated men and women of Bengal into their own religion. So, and I stumbled on the most important figure of that time, Ramakrishna. I have been saturated with hagiographical studies of Ramakrishna. He became in turn Gopala, Krishna, never Rama, by the way. He also became Kali, not just an incarnation of Kali, Kali herself. So all these actually made me to dive into the core Ur-text in vernacular, in Bengali. And there I rediscovered this innocent prankster of Kamatpukul village, Godai. His name was Gadadhar. And then I found out how come Ramakrishna became, in the language of Wendy Doniger's graduate student, Jeffrey Kripal, who also written about Ramakrishna, how was he interested in Kali? How could he become a Tantric, by the way? He should have been a Ramayana, because his home Ishta Devata of which his father Khudiram Chattopadhyay was the priest, was Raghuveer. Ram.
Yeah.
It is very unique in Bengal that you have Ram as the Ishta Devata.
Right.
Although they do respect Ram as the incarnation of Vishnu,
right.
But Krishna is more more popular with the Bengalis. But in the case of Ramakrishna, we find Rama, he came from a Ramayit family, a tradition, but then he turned out to be a Vaishnava.
Okay, let's pause a little bit and let me just summarize what you said. You gave us so many details. Those who are not familiar with Indian or Bengali culture, let me summarize in my own way what you mentioned so deeply. So what Professor Sill has mentioned so far is he's talking about one of the greatest modern Hindu saints. His name was Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa. He was the guru of Swami Vivekananda. And Professor Sill is saying that in Bengali culture, it is very exceptional. It is unique to find somebody who chooses his deity to be the deity of Rama. That is what we find in the life of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa. Professor Sill also referred to a recent book called Kali's Child, written by Jeffrey Kirpal. Jeffrey Kirpal was a student of Professor Wendy Doniger in the University of Chicago. Professor Sill has reviewed Kali's Child and the work of Jeffrey Kirpal in very, very detailed in a very detailed study. We will continue to ask him some more questions on his work also. But as of now, Professor Sill is telling us about the life of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa, one of the greatest modern sages in the Hindu tradition. And let's continue with Professor Sill. Yes, please.
Thank you. Thank you for for your explanation. You did a very good job. So Ramakrishna was my first foray. In 1991, my book on Ramakrishna, even at the risk of becoming a little bit self-centered, I would say this was the first revisionist study in the history or historiography of Ramakrishna. That was my first. My second foray was in the life and work of his disciple. Actually, Vivekananda was not a disciple of Ramakrishna, but he later after he came back from United States, he began to consider and began to publicize that Ramakrishna was his guru. Ramakrishna just said in Bengali, "Ami karo guru noi."
Okay.
"Ami karo chala, amar keu chala nei." Chela is is a shishya. So. But that is in the Bengali text. Many people, those who don't read Bengali text, won't know. My book, my article, first article on Ramakrishna's reconstruction by Vivekananda was published in Netherlands by Brill in their journal called Newman.
Oh, yes.
And that was in 1993.
Oh.
And then Vivekananda's book, my book, Vivekananda, and that is... let me show you. This is the book. It was Vivekananda, a reassessment. And there I showed that instead of a world-conquering monk, Vivekananda was a truly tragic figure. And you have to read it, in order to understand what I'm trying to say. This book, incidentally, got selected as the most academic book by Choice. Choice is the journal of the research libraries of United States.
Okay.
In 1997.
Okay.
And then I did write a book, and I think you said your library, your university library has it, Divine Dowager, Ramakrishna's wife. Again, this is first of its kind.
Okay.
I have seen her as a mother who is not a mother.
Okay.
She was not really a biological mother to anybody because her husband chose to remain ascetic and all that, but she became mother.
Right. Okay, let me pause and summarize what you said. So Professor Sill has just shown his two of his earliest books. One book is on so-called disciple of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa. The disciple's name was Swami Vivekananda, who is very popularly known as the world-conquering Hindu monk, who first Hindu monk to have come to North America in 1893, very, very highly celebrated figure, but Professor Sill is saying that he had a very tragic life. Then the second book that he showed was the book on wife of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa, popularly known as Sharda Mai or Sharda Mata, Mata Sharda, and that those are early, two of your earlier earliest books.
Yeah. In Bengali, she is called Sri Ma, the Blessed Mother. Okay, and my most recent book on Ramakrishna has just been published this year, although its imprint is 2017. It is Ramakrishna Miscellany, a comparative study. I have in this book compared Ramakrishna with Sri Chaitanya and compared Ramakrishna with Martin Luther of Germany. Again, 16th century figure. And this has come from Bratislava, from Slovakia, from Slovak Republic.
Thank you.
Okay. Let me get back to now. Should I get into?
I guess let's since we are continuing on Ramakrishna, I think interesting to hear your views on the book Kali, which was very controversial.
My main theme has been that there is none in this world, no one who cannot be examined as a human being, rather than making dehumanized being a god or an avatar or a great swami. Incidentally, the Swamiji, it's not a Bengali word.
It's
a Hindi word. Swami Sir. And he got it from Rajputana. When he went to Khetri, the prince, he actually called him Swamiji. And that has now become a Bengali word. Everybody is a Swamiji. And the Bengalis don't realize that Vivekananda actually borrowed this from his so-called bhakta, devotee, Raja Ajit Singh of Khetri. I have been asked by, and I did it, by Oxford University Press to write a bibliographical essay on Ramakrishna. And it is Oxford Bibliography Online, OBO. You can just Google it and put my name and you'll find I have analyzed all the sources, Bengali and English, both there. So that was the job I've done. And I had this controversy with Mr. Kripal simply on this score. And that is very important. That is very relevant to the review I have done with Professor Doniger's book. Mr. Kripal, I find, is a very, very intelligent man. He's a very intelligent man, to the extent I sometimes call him Chotu Churamani, meaning he's also very clever. And he has a tremendous power of language. His English is really good. But he also claims that he is the one American, one heck of an American who has deep knowledge of Bengali. And there I caught him. He was in Calcutta for 8 months. And he was incidentally a guest free of charge at the Ramakrishna Mission building at Gold Park in Calcutta. 8 months he was there, and he thinks that he has learned Bengali. He would often call me over the phone and ask me the cultural meaning of some words, like Ramakrishna was saying, Amar buk kemon korche, meaning my heart is feeling something. I told him this is usually the women who say that. And Ramakrishna actually was a bit of a, what should I say, he had a very womanish nature, actually. If you read my book on Ramakrishna, then you will find my most informed book on Ramakrishna is this one.
Crazy in Love of God.
The 2009.
Okay.
And it's called Crazy in Love of God. So Kripal's main theme is that Ramakrishna is a great mystic. Which it takes me, I don't consider Ramakrishna a mystic. I consider him a very colorful, if he's a mystic, he's a very colorful mystic. He was a fun-loving, innocent, man who wanted a good time, who gave good time to people by dancing naked, by talking, giving stories of funny subjects and all that, which people adhere as amritavani, that is nectar-like speech.
Nice.
But Kakraipal, on the other hand, says, Ram, my nickname is Ram. He told me, Ram, you just don't understand your own guru. He was a great mystic. Then I said, if that's so, I disagree with you, but okay. How do you think he is a great mystic? He said, his mysticism is informed by homoeroticism. And I caught him there. I just said, okay, show me anywhere. And then he started giving peculiar, absolutely peculiar interpretation of Ramakrishna's homoeroticism. If it is all right in this situation to tell you verbatim my exchange with him, and that is on the basis of the Kathamrita, that the Bengali diary, that is very important source of this. There Ramakrishna was saying that he suffered from diarrhea. My take is he was a glutton. So he had diarrhea and he didn't have any medicine, like many people in the villages have diarrhea in Bengal. He had diarrhea and then he had also sometimes constipation. So what? He said his diarrhea is when he was open for sodomy. His constipation is he's resisting sodomy. I said, who the hell gave you this idea? I mean, he's there. You read Kali's Child, you will find out. So there I just said, what he has done, I told Kripal in a letter, which I can share with you in any time you want. I can send you that email. I said, you have, I'm sorry to say I cannot use the word, you have done something to Hinduism, which in our country, we take it very seriously. I don't have to be an ardent Hindu, but I just tell you, you have actually, I have to use a bad word. Should I use it?
We got the point, I think.
But you got the point, right?
Yeah. So he,
what he was attaching to Ramakrishna, he has done to Hinduism. That's the point. So his professor, in the preface of Kali's Child, have you read Kali's Child, by the way?
I'm not.
Oh, maybe he is in Texas. Kripal is in Rice University. In the preface, Professor Doniger's right. Her first reaction when she read the book, which was published in 1945, was a hearty laugh.
1995,
yeah. And then he redone it after controversy with me in 1998.
Oh, he did the second edition.
The second one. And the second one has become very popular because he suppressed the first one.
Okay.
First one in 1995, the same title.
Oh, right.
Probably the same university press, Chicago. So what she has done is this.
Now the
that this Hindutva movement of India
right.
is so prudish that it actually is ashamed of Kama Sutra.
Okay.
They want to conceal it. They want to cover it up. And so what she has done, she's saying, Doniger is saying, that it is a great book. India should be proud of this book. It's a national asset. And she's the one who is telling the Indians to how to behave like an Indian, how to be proud of Indian heritage. And what is her take in this book? That is, Bhaktsayana, who was actually a very religious man, on his own terms, if you read Kama Sutra, you will find he's saying that, he's admitting that, he made him a modern guru, and who is open, liberal, who is kind of a supporter of LGBT. I'm using this popular acronym, and that's what Indians don't like. Then she did not show, she mistranslated purposely, that's what I showed in my diary, in my review, that she completely turned around the translation of his Sanskrit.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He talks about Tritiya Prakriti.
Uh-huh.
In vulgar terms, he's talking about the group of people we usually call Hijra.
Yeah, oh, right. Yeah.
Okay? And third nature.
Yeah.
That's the English translation.
Yes.
She's saying, why Richard Burton, who was the first translator of Kama Sutra and a great translator, he said, why did Burton call Tithiya Prakriti eunuch? But where eunuch? There are eunuchs in China. There are eunuchs in India. In ancient cultures, there were eunuchs. Some were them born so, many of them were made so.
Yes.
Yeah? So, you have to say that. But he is calling them sexually entire men.
Uh-huh.
Meaning, he is talking about gay love. Vatsayana had nothing. In fact, he found that to be culpable.
Uh-huh.
And also, Kautilya actually
mm-hmm.
wrote that it is punishable.
Oh.
So therefore, it was not normal. It was something which is attached to dosa, attached to guilt, attached to sin.
Oh.
And and she talks about Kautilya, and she has not read the most important book on Kautilya. It is in English, written by a Bengali. He was the education minister during Indira Gandhi's time, Pratap Chandra Chandra.
Uh-huh.
There's Kautilya on love and morals.
Okay.
Can you see that?
Yes, Kautilya on love and morals, yes. You can read the author's name also. Yeah. What's the author's name?
Okay. It is Pratap Chandra Chandra.
Yes.
Okay. Comes from a very, very famous family.
Okay. We got it. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So he wrote this very important book on Kautilya.
It was a pioneering study.
Pioneering study on Sanskrit.
Yeah, absolutely pioneering study. Its publication date is 1969, I think.
Okay.
1970.
Okay. So that book. Just to summarize what you said so far for our viewers, Professor Sill has written this magnificent review of the book called Redeeming Kama Sutra by Professor Wendy Doniger. Now he is discussing that review of that book by Professor Wendy Doniger, and he's quoting a book called this Kautilya and
Kautilya on Love and Morals.
So Professor Sill is saying that book is being should have been referenced by Wendy Doniger in her review, in her writing of that book Kama Sutra, because both go together hand in hand. Arthashastra and Kama Sutra, they go together, as Professor Sill is explaining further. Please, sir.
Okay, this is the background. This is where I'm coming from. Yes, so right. Go ahead and shoot your questions.
Yes, so how, this is very interesting, I think, even I'm hearing for the first time. How exactly Kama Sutra and Arthashastra was written by Kautilya,
mm-hmm.
Kama Sutra was written by Vatsayana. Mm-hmm. How exactly are they two linked? Can you explain to us?
I think Kama Sutra was written on the style of Arthashastra. Arthashastra comes first. Okay.
Right.
Arthashastra was, it was a science of Shastra. It's a science of Artha, meaning material life.
Yes.
Actually, Artha has many meanings, but it is material success. It is a book of success written for the kings, just like Machiavelli's Prince. It is of that kind. And incidentally, Machiavelli's Prince also is a Renaissance, European Renaissance product. So, both Arthashastra and Kama Sutra are written on this theme in their mind. The authors wanted a stable, happy society.
Yes.
Give me 1 second. I think there is somebody who is trying to come in.
Yeah, sure.
Give me permission to leave you for a moment.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, can we continue?
Yeah.
I lost the video for some reason.
Did you? Oh, okay, yeah. All right.
Oh, yeah, okay, you're back. Okay, yeah. All right, continue. Let's continue. Yes. Okay?
Okay. So.
Right. So, Arthashastra and Kamasutra, yes.
Yeah. Both books were written for. Giving some readers some advice about how to lead a stable, ordered moral life.
Mm-hmm.
In the process, they also talked about, even Kama Sutra has some advice for the rulers.
Mm-hmm.
So these books were, in a way, can be called advice books.
Mm-hmm.
And written by both written by Brahmins,
mm-hmm.
and they were the educated people of their time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so these books are, Kama Sutra is not a pornography.
Yes.
Kama Sutra is, all these Kama Sutra modern versions you find with all sorts of sketches and all that kind of thing, those titillations are not there. In fact, I have to read a few lines from my own review. For your audience.
Yes. Okay. Yes, sure.
I'm just looking at it. Bhaktivinoda is writing himself. He says, I'm quoting from my review. Professor Doniger is attempting to transform an ancient Hindu pandit who averred that while composing the Kama Sutra, he was leading the life of a religious student and wholly engaged in the contemplation of the deity.
Mm-hmm.
This is in Kama Sutra, chapter 7. Book 7, Chapter 2, page 155 in Richard Burton's translation. Now, he was trying to, convert this man into a modern gender expert, revealing, quote, attitudes to women's education and sexual freedom and non-judgmental views of homosexual acts that are strikingly more liberal than those of other texts in ancient India, or in many cases, contemporary India.
Mm-hmm.
This is Kaniger's conclusion.
Okay.
That's why she has written, redeeming Kama Sutra.
Yes.
And I have issues on that.
Right. Yeah, I think what you're saying is that Professor Doniger, as she tried to translate Kama Sutra, she has juxtaposed our contemporary liberal views on Kama Sutra, which is, I think, not fair, because Vatsayan was in his own time and place, and
right.
He was not concerned about gender issues or LGBT issues, and he was leading a very spiritual life, and he
yes.
wrote a religion, like you just mentioned. I'm just summarizing.
The point is, Professor Doniger, a great Sanskritist, I have no question on that, but she is not a historian.
Yeah.
She is not a historian. So therefore, she loses the historical empathy of the time. So I wrote, Doniger seeks to excavate titillating erotic messages and passages similar to Kama Sutra from Kautilya's magnum opus, the Arthashastra.
Right.
Kautilya, basically, in Book 4, Chapter 13, Verse 40, clearly said that a person who will engage in sex, ajanu, without the vagina, with a woman, punishable.
Okay.
And a man trying to have sex with another man is punishable.
Oh, really? Okay.
But same Kautilya has said, any man who is caught having sex with the queen will have to suffer what he called kumbhipaka. Kumbhipaka in Sanskrit means being boiled in a jar.
Okay. Wow. So he was not by any stretch a kind of a liberal that one might want to juxtapose on Kautilya or on Vatsyayana. They were not.
Right. They were traditional. They were very, very proud Hindus.
Mm-hmm.
And they are also highly educated.
Yes, highly qualified Brahmins. And
very, very qualified persons. So, Chanakya, for example, was a great man. How did he die? He died, first of all, he defied the new monarch after Chandragupta, his son Bindusara. He had a quarrel with him. And he told Bindusara openly how he was born. There was some mystery about his birth. And then he retired himself, sold his every possession, became an ascetic, an anchorite, and died in a forest.
Wow. Chanakya.
He was not hanged or shot. I mean, I'm using bad words. He was not punished. He was not executed. He just led his life and ended his on his own terms. So he was a great man.
Right. Yeah, he lived a heroic life and prepared Chandragupta, and Chandragupta gives response to Alexander, right? And then they unite all these tribes or the smaller kingdoms. And they
and all that. And he wrote how to maintain that empire.
Yes.
That's the point.
Right.
Only person I can compare him with is a later person from Europe, from Italy, Marsilius of Padua, hero, defender of peace, defensor Pacis. That and Arthashastra, one day, I don't know when I will have time, one day I will compare.
Okay. Yeah, and you also mentioned Machiavelli, who can be probably, he is compared with Kautilya Chanakya.
I my very long article, 40 pages article, Kautilya and Machiavelli, was published by Indiana University's Journal of Modern Indian History. Modern Asian History.
Wonderful.
We'll
get into that, I guess, probably in the next episode. But today, let's come back to, so what do you see the connection between Kali's child and Kama Sutra? So one is written by Wendy Doniger's student, Jeffrey Kipal. And then Wendy Doniger herself wrote this Kama Sutra book. What are the connections? What are the problems in both?
Americanized Hinduism. As simple as that. Crudely, but truly. If this is the case, Americanize Hinduism. See Hinduism, make the Hindus like Americans. It is a cultural invasion. In a benevolent way. In a legitimate way. Why? Through academe. Through scholarship. They are all giving you the footnotes and other things, everything that they have written, they have gone through the sources. But they are manipulating the sources.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, you have to know there. And Kripal, he is not Kripal. I used to think that he is Kripal Singh or something like that. No, he is Kripal. And he has nothing to do with anything called Kripal. So the Kripal, he's basically a Jewish background person of Jewish. So is ONP, by the way. ONP Janjar was ONP O Playharty.
Oh, yes.
I do, kind of.
Yes.
So, their main idea is I call it Neo-Orientalism.
Very important and very useful term, actually. Neo-Orientalism.
Yes, it is Neo-Orientalism. And that's the only way we can see. But we can learn from them. Oh. They have done a lot of work. They have gone into great details about things which, as Indians, we may take for granted but never look into it. But by the same token, they have made themselves vulnerable. Because then, if you go through their sources, then you'll find out what kind of manipulation has been made.
Right. So the same issues you see in both, similar issues.
Similar issues.
Constitution issues. Wrong kind of a stereotypical perspective towards looking at Hindu tradition from, as you said, very American way or very neo-orientalist way to look at the Hindu tradition. Can you talk about a little bit more how exactly, can you define what you mean by neo-orientalism for viewers who may be very new to this idea of the orientalism or neo-orientalism? What exactly do you mean, cultural invasion, or a little bit more?
Okay, both of them feel the Indians are very prudish, very pernickety with regard to body, which is a wrong thing. Indians are very body conscious. Yoga, the science of yoga tells people, and they're teaching the world about body, actually. But they say the Indians are very prudish about sex, for example. They're why? It is the fault of the British evangelicals. Those missionaries have brought in this idea of sex being bad. And Indians still today they believe in this. And she immediately brings in this Hindutva movement, and he says, in the name of getting into the culture, what they are doing, they are perpetuating and popularizing prudery. And both Wendy and her brainchild Jeffrey, both of them have a mission to rescue the Indians from themselves.
We need their civilizing mission to civilize.
Yes, that's what I call neo-orientalism. That's why. There it is. And I actually challenged Mr. Kripal to hold some conversation in Bengali, or take a book, core book, that he has read, and I read one page and discuss how do we understand that page. I will pay for you. I'll pay for his plane. Somebody in New Jersey, very kindly, some radio station kindly offered a venue for us. That I said, I will pay for his journey. I will pay for his stay. And come. He didn't accept it.
Very, very interesting, very interesting. So the entire controversy around Kali's Child, when it came out in 1995, the first edition and the second edition, you were kind of also participant in that controversy and So what happened to that? So that controversy, I think, do you think it gave a message to people like scholars like Kripal, or was it a good thing, the entire controversy? And
that controversy spawned a very interesting character.
Uh-huh.
He is a monk of the Ramakrishna order.
Oh, yes.
He is based in Boston.
Yes.
Swami
Tyagananda.
Tyagananda.
Yes.
He was the one, I have still his letter. He first approached me, introducing himself, who he was, and he wanted to have a talk with me, and then we went. And then he actually attacked every line of Kripal's Bengali, although Tyagananda is not a Bengali. I should tell you, sotto voce, in a low voice, he's not Bengali. I figured that out also. But he has tremendous knowledge of Bengali grammar. So that's okay. Tyagananda has now come out as an Americanized scholar, but Hindu. He has all the vocabulary of American Academy, absolutely all vocabulary. He writes well. Actually, his co-author, her name is Prabhrajika Brajaprana.
Yes.
She's an American, I think, and they both together they wrote a book, a final book. And Pagananda then does not attack me because I don't recognize Ramakrishna as an avatar. I do not recognize Ramakrishna as a genuine mystic, but at the same time, I love Ramakrishna. He doesn't understand how can a Bengali do that, that I do. He didn't understand. That's why I'm saying he's not Bengali also in that sense. Tyagananda, he is done in a very, very suave manner, manipulating Kripal's objectionable things, putting it aside, and then essentializing hagiographical Ramakrishna.
Oh, I see, I see. So probably Swami Tyagananda is looking at Ramakrishna as an incarnation and as a like a holy mystic and all that, very, very like divinization.
Yes.
Okay.
It is Vivekananda writ large. Oh. Vivekananda made Ramakrishna practical Vedantist.
Yes.
And the practical Vedanta is a nonsense, by the way. I mean, you read Amritananda Ramachand's, Professor Amritananda Ramachand's a critique of Vivekananda's Vedantism. It's a magisterial book. It was published by Hawaii, University of Hawaii Press some years ago. And it's a great book. So Tyagananda has created some kind of an atmosphere where it is okay, even if you are a very liberal-minded person and really not a temple goer regularly, but Hindu, it is okay to accept Ramakrishna for what he was. And what he was a superman. More than Tyagananda, you should know, have you been to Calcutta recently?
Not recently, but
okay. Recently, in Calcutta, there is a young man who has become an assistant professor at Ramakrishna Vivekananda University at Belur, Belur Math, monastery, the famous place which was started by Vivekananda, and they have now opened a new university. This man has a brilliant CV. He is highly trained in German philosophy. And I think he can write German even. And he has now come forward. Well, he also came in contact with me. Okay. He now comes forward and to tell that Ramakrishna, he has made Ramakrishna as in my, what should I say, in my crude version, Dr. Gadadhar Chatterjee, professor of practical Vedanta. He has turned Ramakrishna into a professor. Which Ramakrishna would never have recognized himself as. So therefore, they don't really see how, I mean, I think I am a better devotee of Ramakrishna than any one of these.
Okay.
Simply because I do not dehumanize him. I do not make him a god. I do not make him for what he is not. Mm-hmm. But I still like him. Oh. He's a good guy.
Very interesting. Thank you. I think, should we stop here or you want to add something else to this topic of Ramakrishna or Kama Sutra?
No, if any one of your students or colleagues have read the review and have some question to ask, I'm open.
Okay.
You can ask me that question on their behalf if they have one.
Okay. Okay. I guess, we can talk a little bit more on Vivekananda, like, what is your perspective on Swami Vivekananda? You were saying something in the beginning that he was a very different kind of a person than popularly, what, how is popularly known?
Vivekananda, like Karl Marx, never liked the life they chose.
Ah, okay.
Marx wanted to be a university professor, didn't get it. So he became a journalist. And from journalist, he became a revolutionary. Even though he did not like the destructive revolutionary army or something like that. He was a bourgeois. He was a bourgeois par excellence. Similarly, Vivekananda would have liked to become, as he said, Vivekananda told his friend in Bengali, Amra Bhav Rajya Rohiravat. That means we are the mammoth of intellectual world.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to be a professor.
Oh, okay.
He didn't get a job because he had only a bachelor's degree and a very poor bachelor's degree. If you read his mark sheets, in Indian language it's mark sheet transcript called, in United States called it transcript. You can read transcript reprinted in Comprehensive Life of Vivekananda by a professor, two volume books. It's in English and you'll find what kind of a student he was. He learned, but he had this gift of the gab. He was fluent in English. That's why many educated Bengali, even without the BA degree in his time, were. I mean, that was the influence of British influence. And then he was never a student of Presidency College. The 1 year he was there. And for mysterious reasons, he transferred himself next year without sitting for any exams in, you know, in the college, in the, you have annual exam, annual test. Without sitting that, he went to General Assembly's institution, which later on became Scottish Church College.
Awesome.
And he graduated from there. And he had no major. He graduated, he read a few texts. I think he read a textbook on Western philosophy, but he did not read any Western philosopher by himself.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Vivekananda. His main idea was that he went to Ramakrishna. He hated to go to Ramakrishna. His brother who took him there, he said, I will feed you Rasagulla if you meet this man. You will like him. So he just said, okay, because of that, I will go. But I will twist his ears if he tries to tell me something about religion, because he is illiterate. I know that. That's what Vivekananda, the genuine, the guy. Then he went there. When his father died, his father left nothing for the family. So he was actually starving almost. And that his life was changed when he went to United States. And he went to United States with a dress that is not the dress of a monk in India. It was in a theatrical way, in headgear and colorful robe. An ascetic doesn't have that kind of money to buy those things. It is Raja Ajit Singh bought everything for him and sent him there. He reinvented himself thanks to American women.
Okay.
Swami Nikhilananda, who was in Boston at one time, he died some years ago, who translated Ramakrishna's Kathamrita in English for the first time, the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Very, very respectable translation. Nikhilananda said in his preface that Swami Vivekananda is America's best gift to India.
Okay.
This is, I'm exactly quoting him. So he was made by the Americans, basically, women. If you read my separate articles on Vivekananda and women, and one has been published as a monograph with Monash University, Australia, is called Prophet Disarmed, Vivekananda and Nivedita. Then you will see, I have tried to show, and I have no shame in mouthing it. Many people will not like my saying. You will see his veiled seduction, or his attempt and veiled seduction of Nivedita. He first told her he is a veer, he is a hero. Veer.
Yeah, veer.
Then he told he is a murderer. He has been born to be a sacrifice because of Mother Kali has meant that way. And he also told her that he loved reading Romeo and Juliet. Then he told her on his way to Amarnath, that was the most crucial time and crucial turning point in the Swami's career, that he wanted to marry only for his mother's sake, if not for anything, but it is too late, he can't marry. So these are the kind of things. I would say, in my reckoning, 1897 is the time when Vivekananda returns from Amarnath in the Himalayas. His body was a temple of disease. He had all kinds of disease. And he defiantly said, "I don't like medics. They are giving you prescriptions in order to keep you alive so that they can make money." It sounds pretty good, but it sounds irresponsible. He ate a lot. He smoked like a chimney. He learned how to drink wine in the United States. And he ate what is called the cream in huge amount. And he, of course, ate beef. That's okay. I mean, in the United States, you go there. He was questioned by a great Vedantist of Switzerland. He's a very famous man who wrote first in Vedanta, first European to write on Vedanta. He told Vivekananda, "You seem to be well fed. You smoke all the day. What did you renounce? He said, "I renounced women." And he said that he quotes that conversation. Then he writes, "What a shame, what a loss, such a handsome man, he just hates women." But that was Swami Vivekananda. When he found out that he was going to die, because he had tremendous asthma and he couldn't sleep at night, when he slept, he was making horrible groaning noise. Wow. One of his devotees, he was on the second floor, one of his devotees on the first floor heard that and couldn't figure out. He then writes, "Swamiji was so much feeling for the poor and for the deprived that he cries all night." He was not crying. He was crying for life. He was crying for taking breath. He had breathing difficulty.
Wow.
So Vivekananda was a victim of psychosomatic trauma. And Vivekananda, psychotrauma is, he rather unwittingly held on to an imagined manliness by depriving himself of practical manhood. That was his tragedy. So that's what I felt, and I have to just end this conversation with my last comment. People don't realize that I am not there to badmouth Swami Vivekananda. I'm writing, "Swami Vivekananda emerges from a century-old gilded cage of myth and mystification, not as the herald of a brave new world of spiritual humanism, but as a tragic figure whose brief but tumultuous public life was spent contending with multiple tensions and conflicts, much less attractive, but probably more authentic and eminently human." This is my take on Vivekananda.
Okay, thank you. Any other closing words before we stop this conversation for now?
No, I mean, I'm just saying, when can I see your edited encyclopedia coming out? Has it come out already?
Probably next year now. Yeah.
Next year, yeah. I mean, it takes time because you still are expecting contributions.
Yes.
Yeah, I could see that, yeah. So anything that you find, this is time, anything that you find that needs to be corrected, let me know.
Okay, sir. Thank you so much.
Very nice meeting you. Very nice meeting you. Enjoyed chit-chatting. I could have used, had you been together in real life, actually together outside of this cyber world, I could have used some Bengali in order to make my point.
Oh, yes. We'll definitely meet maybe one of these days in the future.
Okay,
Thank you for your time. We'll talk more later on. Thank you.